All right.
Well, we let me get Grudem's book in front of me here. I have read everything. I didn't get a nice, neat way in my mind of presenting it, so it's gonna go however it organically goes. But this is our second and last week, so we'll finish. I turned it on and did. We'll finish this chapter this week, 23, the essential nature of man. And I guess it has these two parts. They kind of organically go together. We looked at the first one was we introduced and looked at the terms, the three different views on the constituent nature of a human being, body, trichotomy, three parts, spirit, soul, and body, dichotomy, two parts, body and soul and spirit being used interchangeably there. And then there's the monism view, the singular view that man doesn't have a spiritual side to him. And so he's just listening to him now.
Okay.
Yeah. So I don't think we have much discussion on that. I think everybody took a dichotomous view that man was Grudem. I don't think anyone had any quibbles with the points Grudem made, but that sort of leads into the next one, the next issue, because once you confess that man has an immaterial soul. An immortal soul, not because it's just some power out there, but that has to be immortal. God could destroy it, but immortal in the sense that he's willed for it to last forever. But once we confess that, then we have the problem of the origin of the soul, and where did the soul come from? And I don't know how many of you read that part. It was a pretty short part. It's page 484 and really just 485. But you got three different views on this too. Obviously, we can get the first one out of the way pretty quick. The pre-existence of the soul, that would be like a very almost a reincarnational type thing. Comes from Plato and Greek philosophy and all of that, the soul was somehow there from the beginning, or God created certain number of souls. Origen did hold to that view. He held a lot of quirky things, and thus John Frame calling the church fathers the church babies. Of course, they didn't have 2,000 years of work to look back on, like we do.
Who called them church babies?
John Frame. Yeah. Just in the sense of trying to bring out, like, they had a lot of errors in there, but anyway, Origen did have that view. He's the only one. It was pretty much dismissed. So the second one coming up from it is traducianism. some call it generationism instead, because traditionism comes from the word trans, to go across, and deuce is to lead. So to lead across, it's like the soul is passed down procreatively from one parent to the next, to the next person. I think it was it Tertullian? Yeah, who originally held to that. But he believed the human soul was material, though, made of matter. And so he was infected by that thought. But anyway, the arguments for traditionism would be things like, their main one would be, you know, God rested from all his work, Genesis 2:3. He's not creating anything directly anymore. Everything's running off of secondary causes, like we studied in Doctrine of Providence. They would point to Genesis 5:3, that Adam had a son in his own image and likeness, and things of that sort. And so they take the view, traditionists take the view, Martin Luther had that view. He abandoned it at the end and became a creationist at the end. Augustine never took a view. He went back and forth. A lot of men have not taken a view. But in general, creationism won the day, so to speak. There are a few traditionists still. They're a dying breed, pretty much. But there's a few of them out there. The reason creationism began to win the day, just to throw some of this out there, is traditionism has a harder time explaining things. For example, here is a quote from Bavinck. He says, "Traditionism neither explains the origin of the soul nor the hereditary transmission of sin." If you take that as being translated, you know, where was the soul before conception? Was it in the trying to think of a euphemism to use? Was it in the seed? Was it in the egg? Was it in the seed and the egg? There's been all kinds of weird stuff proposed on that. It's hard to avoid the pre-existence of the soul idea, you know. In other words, you get to this idea that, like, say I had, you know, multiple conceptions and miscarriages. Mm-hmm. Well, then, like I have 100 souls within me or something, you know. So it lands on that, or it somehow says, he says, that the soul was potentially present in the seed of the man or the woman, or in both. And thus they run up against the materialistic view, you know. So that's the difficulty of it. Trying to see some good quotes in here to bring out. He says, even if one answers, let me bring it back here. He's dealing with this question. Some people get real technical on how this might would happen. He says, if one answers that God gave to the seed and the egg the capacity on being united to produce a soul that neither of them had prior to the union, but that is still spiritual and immortal, then we are actually dealing with another form of creationism. So in that sense, it's just a mystery. So he says, when traditionism pursues its own logic, it either lapses into materialism or again smuggles in creationism into its tent under another label. And so I'm not a traditionist, for whatever that's worth. I think it is worth something. It is worth thinking through. Some of the guys who are traditionists, this connects to their view of the original sin and, Romans 5, about how men are held accountable for sin. Lots of men through history have fallen into the error of thinking of sin as being physical rather than ethical. And so there's this almost view that, like, a new human being comes into the world, they're judged guilty by God because they're part of this yeast pile of humanity that's been infected by sin. So it's almost viewed as a physical sickness or a disease that's permeating the human nature. And they get it because they came from the same stock. And then once they're created, they're judged guilty for having it. But that's not the right view. Can't be the right view. What he's about to look at here for creation guards against that. It's not. There's one in Deuteronomy, there's one in Jeremiah, there's one in Ezekiel where God says he will not hold the sons guilty for the father's sins. And you say, well, how do you reconcile that with Romans 5? Well, that's the answer, that there's no organic guilt being passed down. He made a covenant. He made a sovereign decision to make a covenant with Adam and the whole human race, just as he made a sovereign decision to make a covenant with Christ and all who would trust in him. And so it doesn't work off of, we shouldn't have the idea, many people miss embracing Reformed theology, I think, because they get the wrong idea of how sin is passed down. They don't have a federal legal view of it. They have like an organic physical view of it, where they think what we're saying is Adam fell, the whole human race was, when we get to it in the doctrine of sin, there's two parts to original sin. There's original guilt and original pollution, but the guilt is always the basis of the pollution. The pollution is never the basis of the guilt.
Right.
That's the issue. So this other view would seem to imply that I am born polluted because the whole human race is fallen, of which I partake. I then go out and sin with this depraved nature, and I then am judged for that sin. And that hits people as unjust, and rightfully so, would be. God himself says he don't do that. And so It's a legal. I'm judged. The whole human race was immediately condemned when Adam sinned. Period. It's over with. That condemnation is over with. That's why babies can die in the womb, not because they sinned in the womb. They had an attitude in the womb about something. That's not it. At the moment of conception, something can go wrong in the genes and stuff, and so it's not based off that. But anyways, throw that out there. Traditionism has been associated with that. Now creationism still has its problems. It can nail down when the soul is created, which you would take the view at conception. They give several verses. You know, at Genesis 2:7, God put the soul into Adam, you know. Ecclesiastes, the spirit returns to God who gave it. Hebrews calls him the father of spirits. There's a verse in Numbers 16 calls him the God of all spirits. Zechariah 12:1 says God formed the spirit of man within him. In Isaiah 42:5, who gives breath to the people on it in spirit, to those who walk in it. Now, I'm pretty excited to talk about this part because there is a new baby on the way. And it is something I was really taken back by Bavinck here. I'll just read these couple things and we can toss around any thoughts. But he says creationism can no more explain this mystery than traditionism, but it has the advantage over the latter theory in that it is prepared respectfully to leave this mystery alone and not to subject it to spurious explanation. So creationism confesses that it doesn't know how the soul is created. It doesn't know how God joins the soul to the body. It says here, but at the proper time he does, and in a manner incomprehensible to us. He says, in keeping with this, accordingly, the hereditary transmission of sin cannot be explained by saying that the soul, though first created pure by God, is polluted by the body, for in that case, sin would be materialized. You see, again, this issue, it wrestles with sin somehow being passed down physically rather than judicially, you know. And we struggle with this all the time. Like, when people die, there's something in science known as telomeric aging, telomeric death, that the telomeres on the genes just stop producing. And if the genes stop producing in your heart, you have a heart attack. But the thing is all of the physical stuff going on with the earth is a judgment, is a judicial judgment. It's not natural. It's not the way nature was meant to work. And so, let me try to find a couple final quotes here that'll get to the part I was wanting to get to. Here it is. Physical descent alone would have resulted in a situation where the sin we receive from Adam would be a deterministic fate, a process of nature, a sickness that had nothing to do with our will and hence did not imply any guilt on our part. That is not what sin is, nor is the righteousness of Christ, as the last Adam confers on us, of that nature. Both the sin and the righteousness presuppose a federal relation between humanity as a whole and its heads. Thus, creationism maintains that every human person, this is the big part to listen to, is the best part, Bavinck wrote, is an organic member of humanity as a whole, and by that he means physically. Like, I got my physical cells from my dad, who got his from his dad, and all the way back to Adam, so there's this organic whole. And at the same time, that in that whole, he or she occupies an independent place of his or her own. It upholds the unity of the human race in its entirety, and at the same time, the independent significance of every individual. human beings are not specimens, not numbers of a kind, nor are they detached individuals like the angels. They are both parts of the whole and individuals. Creationism preserves the organic, both physical and moral, unity of humanity, and at the same time, it respects the mystery of the individual personality. This part, particularly this sentence, every human being, while a member of the body of humanity as a whole, is at the same time a unique idea of God with a significance and destiny that is eternal. Like, in other words, he's saying God is literally directly creating the human soul at the point of conception. And somehow in a mystery known to us, attaching it to that conceived flesh. This view would make abortion more heinous. It is to literally rip the cup out of my hands. God is actively creating a person, but it attaches this significance to each individual person. This was a quote I was reading when you come back in, Jeremy. He says, this is a part that was making me think of the baby. It says, every human being, while a member of the body of humanity as a whole, is at the same time a unique idea of God with a significance and destiny that is eternal. Every human being is himself or herself an image of God, and yet that image is only fully unfolded in humanity as a whole. But he puts an exclamation mark on this point that that a human being is a unique, there's an extra uniqueness that comes with embracing creationism, that the body of this person is joined in a unity to all other persons, but the soul of this person is completely distinct identity. Then produces the plurality of the human race, that we're not all the same. He even goes into research on genetics and how stuff is passed down, and Babbitt does. And if I could find it in here, here it is. He says, no person, and particularly no person like, say, he names this man, can be explained purely by genetics from his parents or ancestors. Neither the physical stature of someone's father nor his mother's happy disposition give us any indication for understanding how this extraordinary personality came about. And just as genius suddenly makes its appearance, so also its marks soon disappear. And he says, granted, for years now, an intense study has been made of the laws of heredity, but until now, the result only consists in the knowledge that heredity is a complex question. And he says, they've been able to shed little or no light on the extent and manner of heredity transmission. In other words, he's arguing here again for the uniqueness of a human soul, that each human being we come across is, in the ultimate sense of the word, a mystery, a complete mystery as to where they even came from, how God made them, and it's a big thought to take in. Good thought, it seems to me, the mystery of the human personality and the unique. There, it seems like it should communicate something to me of like, you know, they guard the Mona Lisa, the original Mona Lisa. Like, if you destroy the original Mona Lisa, then it's there isn't another one. You know, like, it should give me this weight and this sense of like, there has never been, nor will there ever be another Corey. Ever. Never was, never will be. Like, total uniqueness to human personality.
One thing on that point that I saw, Grudem seems to kind of also tie in to the mystery that there, it does seem that you take on some traits of your parents,
mm-hmm.
your personality. That was like at the end of 485. I thought that was interesting. So you would define like the soul as being anything, like we look at somebody dies and there's a body there, and so the soul is going to be the way you think, your personality, all this.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I'm saying there's some kind of mystery to it. There's obviously a. You know, when you get down to it, you're like, what's the difference of my brain and my soul? Like, my soul has a mind, the ability to think. But it's a mystery. It's meant to animate the brain and animate the body and shine out through the human body. The human personality is meant to come through it, and no one knows that connection. I mean, it's deep, deep, mysterious connection. You know.
Yeah, I just thought it was interesting. Like somehow through it, you can see how some
stuff gets passed down.
To the kids. But yet, they're still one of a kind. But, you know, it's kind of like there's a special glory in that. Kind of like in what Paul talks about, all the stars have a unique glory and the moon has its glory. That there's some way like people of like the Morgan clan, they kind of have a unique glory, and the Mercers have like maybe a particular glory that you may see in some of the children, and you know, it's just interesting to think how that kind of works out. But
yeah, that's a deep mystery. I mean, just so you know, the traditionist camp would fault the creationist camp with like God being the author of sin here too, because you got God creating. Like, how do you explain that? Like, the moment this person comes into existence, they're fallen, polluted. So you got God directly creating a human soul that's fallen. See that? And so...
I think David says he was conceived in sin, which is always thought was an interesting way to... I think most people look at that as what you're saying, like at conception. When I first read that phrase, I think that there was like maybe it was sin in the way that the conception happened, but some person was looking at it based on kind of like that judicial aspect that
mm-hmm.
it's trying to get at this thing of being born under sin.
Right, their problem would be you're literally saying God created my soul wicked. You see, because if you say you're born with a wicked heart, and you say God directly creates the heart in the person, now you got the mystery of providence in full hilt right here. And so I most definitely don't think the Bible teaches God creates the wicked heart in the man. Although I do see the creationist view. And so my only possible thought on it would be, it's possible, I don't know this, but it's possible for that human soul to exist for a millisecond in purity and to fall the very next millisecond as a result of the judicial judgment of, you know, because ultimately, like I said, the pollution is the result of the guilt, not guilt result of the pollution. So the human race falls and becomes sinful because of Adam's sin. That's the point. They're not born sinful and then go and sin from that so-called sin nature, which then incurs their damnation. That's not how it works. They're damned in Adam's sin that happened a long time ago. Now they accumulate more, but that's not the ultimate basis of their condemnation. But that is what the traditionist camp would see. They're like, well, you're teaching that God literally makes a person sinful and then sends them out in the world to sin and then judges them for their sin.
Now, I had some sort of false expectation of that. Like, I have.
Oh, I have too.
Like, these are new thoughts hitting me. You know, I'm trying to make a distinction between this hereditary view, sinful nature. And I'm trying to, I'm having a hard time making a distinction in my mind between what you just said, being condemned representatively. Judicially,
yes, better word for it.
As opposed to, like, I mean, I get it. I understand the pollution and the, as you worded it, pollution, the other word you used, the pollution,
guilt.
The guilt. I get that. Like, the pollution didn't cause the guilt, but the guilt there, the pollution flows from that guilt.
Right.
So I just,
for simple minded,
I'm going to hold off on saying too much at this point. I didn't read it, obviously.
Yeah.
So there's point one and problem one.
Well, he didn't really, just in these two pages, Grudem didn't really go into its relation to original sin, probably because he deals with it. That's where he goes in the next chapter. So sin is his next chapter, will be next time. But
yeah, I did have this view. I don't know if I can cut you off or
no.
Before, but this view, there was something about in creation. I had this view, and I'm not leaving it. But this conversation has caused me to question that there was something in creation. God created our souls. There was something in there that was given to us that we have a propensity to sin.
Mm-hmm.
That's not directly, it's not just representatively.
You mean like we have an actual bent towards sin? Yeah. That's the pollution.
That's the pollution.
But that bent is a result of God declaring us guilty in Adam.
But I don't see how you're making. See, my mind, I don't see that distinction there. The pollution from the guilt. I don't see like this. Somehow it's a separation because I got to think on this one. I just got to think on this.
I totally understand it.
Yeah. I thought John, for the simple minded folks like me, brought that down to a
box of crayons.
I could get my mind around when I got through this section. I said, wait a minute. This is for people, you know, all these deep man. let me go find I thought John personally did pretty good, but he didn't get near as in right. depth, and he didn't say it wasn't a lot of it wasn't a mystery,
right?
Anything like that. But I thought he came to a conclusion that was pretty good. My memory don't recall every word of it. It's been several weeks since I read it.
Right.
But. Yeah. So like that passage. The passage can leper changes spots.
Right.
Can you do good who is accustomed to doing evil or something like that? Like,
yeah.
I thought that there's something, like I'm taking that, like a leper is created with spots. Like they're in the creation.
Yeah.
They're created a certain way and they can't change certain things about them. I can't right. change the fact that, you know, I got two hands, I got two feet. But
right.
I was always taking it as like God created us in us, if you want to use the Jeremiah's passage of the heart. God created in us something that was corrupt, and therefore it produced corruption.
Yeah, and of course the doctrine of depravity is the men, whether they're traditionists or creationists, they're holding that. The leopard can't change his spots and all of that. The doctrine, inability and all of that. What they're asking is more a question of, brings in a doctrine of providence, number one, and original sin. Not my personal sin, but the representative sin of Adam. So those two, so they're agreeing that the disagreement between the two is my depravity the foundational basis of my guilt before God, which leads to the charge of injustice, which the Reformed creationist camp would say is an unbiblical charge of justice. We're not dealing with injustice. We're not dealing with a Romans 9 situation. Of course, the other camp would say that. So they would be saying this is an extra charge, an unnecessary charge of injustice. And of course, you got the verses there that God doesn't hold guilty son for his father's sins. My mind has gone that way anyway. It used to bother me. I'm glad I finally saw this because I accepted it. I thought it's what Scripture was teaching for a long time, that the pollution is the basis of the guilt. And yes, it is the basis of extra guilt, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. But like we do sin with our sin nature. And we do sin because we're sinners. We're not sinners because we sin. That's there. But that's what we're doing in our own personal life. And that's a totally different question than the representatives of Adam and Christ. And so, and the fact that we got into this polluted situation not because of our sins, not because of any sin I committed out of this polluted nature, but from the sin that Adam committed. What you thinking over there, Mr. Ford? You pondering something?
I'm slower than everybody else. But when you look at the question at hand, I thought maybe I misunderstood. But where did the soul come from?
Mm-hmm.
Where did it come from?
Does it come from the parents or directly by God? Mm-hmm.
So,
well, it does get into these other things because,
yeah,
you know.
Go ahead.
Well, that is a question. It's just it ripples. It.
It's deep.
It dominoes, you know, logically into all kind of other.
And there's multiple views.
Right.
Of how and when that happened by.
Right.
A lot of theologians that are that have studied it pretty in depth.
Yeah, I mean, you can even take the view that, like, it. Some people have thought, does the soul not attach to the body until like week six? You know?
Right, yeah.
Well, Gruden says, he leaves it open-ended. He says sometime between. He said the creationism view is sometime between conception and birth. So apparently there's like this range of week nine, or, you know.
Yeah, I saw that. I don't think he's right on that point, my own view on it. I mean, because the only accounts we have in Scripture of humans within the womb, they're called by the same word that they're called when they're out of the womb. So it's sort of presumptuous to me to sort of pontificate that they wouldn't be called a person.
What about John the Baptist? What week was he in? You think?
He was sometime between his fifth and sixth month.
Fifth and sixth month.
But my point is, he was called a baby, and in Luke 2, Jesus outside the womb was called a baby, and Luke used the same Greek word for both. Mm-hmm. So, by that example, we see the biblical writers refer to babies inside the womb with the same terminology outside the womb. We don't have any account of any indication that they would limit that.
So they would say a miscarriage is not even a soul.
Well, if you took that view, you could justify abortion up to the, 'cause it's not even a full image of God, human being.
Yeah,
you know.
And they do it, you know, unless you got the whole body outside of it, the partial birth abortion was like.
Yeah.
I don't think it's a person.
So I'm thinking, like, when you're talking about killing a person, or possibly killing a person, that's not something you just want to leave that one alone. It's kind of, who would, in deer hunt, like, it might be a deer. It's just,
yeah. Thank you, brothers.
All right, bro. So I think, to me, the safer stance to guard against all that is to say, so far as I can tell, somehow in a mysterious way, the soul is directly created by God and attached to the body at the point of conception, and I don't know how he involves the parent in it or doesn't involve the parent in it, and it gives to each individual human personality deep mystery and significance. And I can't imagine, I don't even know the motive of wanting to come out. There's no biblical text that would push me to embrace some kind of view that it soul gets attached at week 20 or something like that.
And well, then, you know, he says, I knew you before the foundation of the world. He knew you and chose you.
Right.
So,
yeah, I'm that persuasion that, like, you know, when conception happens and a human being is here, like when conception happens, a human being is here, providence has revealed the eternal will of God was for there to be another person. you know. And that moment on, they have their own individual significance. But it is a mystery to know how God could directly create their fallen soul. Because that's what you're dealing with. Because see, that's why the question is, simply put, like you said, where does the soul come from? The parent or the or God directly creates it and attaches it to what comes from the parent, the flesh. Once you say that, then they bring in the doctrine of sin. Okay, how does this human soul fall in? If God created it directly.
If we turn around and look at Esau and Jacob, while they were still in the womb, Esau, I hate it.
Some people may say that don't fit. I don't know, but it's. Well, I think that would be choosing between two sinful children. You know, choosing one versus, not that they've already committed their own individual acts of sin or whatever, but
that's true.
The mystery is, how does God directly create right at the point of conception a new human soul, or whatever point it would be at, thought of, how does he create a new human soul, and at the same time it's polluted and fallen?
I guess the struggle is because the only example of what he created would be Adam, so we know he created Adam and Eve without a polluted soul.
And nothing is really even said of Eve's soul, just Adam. But yeah, we do know Adam was lifeless and until that moment. I mean, we do have these verses that say he forms the spirit within man. So he's somehow actively doing it. But the traditionists would point out and say, well, it also says he forms me in my mother's womb. So, like, that doesn't cross out that it couldn't somehow be inherited. The soul can somehow be inherited. But like Babink is saying, none of them answers the mystery, because then once you try to project the soul back, now you're getting into, like, the pre-existence of the soul. Or you run up against materialism, because the soul was somehow part of the seed or the egg.
It's the hidden chromosome or something, you know?
Yeah. Which is a very animalistic, evolutionary kind of view. Or that it's just somehow a physical human being in the womb has the ability to rise to psychic life at some point. Like, again, it's some kind of materialistic view, which doesn't match that when the body dies, the soul goes. So there's not this natural organic connection to where the body and the soul don't both die. There is this mysterious part of man that we don't fully comprehend, but it's there.
And the body and the soul, like, develop together, you know.
Mm-hmm. So, like,
a 2-year-old has, like, kind of an infant soul about them.
Right.
And their bodies, you know, it's kind of like this correlation.
Yeah. Well, I kind of look at it. I mean, we've got some pretty intelligent people in this world. Mm-hmm. And the mind, how much much of it do they truly really understand?
Not much.
No. So.
Yeah.
Are so we? Are we ever going to truly, totally understand? At some part, it has to be faith.
No.
In God, the Creator. At the parts that we can't understand.
Yeah.
I mean, he gave us the ability to understand quite a bit.
It did for me. I know this discussion, as we're wrapping it up here, may seem, if we've had any discussion as far as it seems obtuse and stratosphere and not down to earth, just that one part about God directly creating the soul, if you take that view, I did feel like that gave me something down to earth that as a Christian, having that doctrine, like I should above all other men, esteem and value a human being, you know, in a radically different way. If I think this was the way Babine described it, like this was a unique, eternal thought in God's mind, realized. Pretty incredible. It produces a uniqueness to one human being, even in a world of 6 billion other people, a uniqueness.
Well, it even goes in as far as the value of life and culture today in the world. So, I mean, you look at we're no longer valuing life.
It's not. I think we don't realize. I think unless something changes, we could see. We don't. I was reading this book of Annabelle Martin Luther King Jr. last night about the segregation or whatever. It's like one of her school books. And I had this thought while we were reading it. Like, we look back on those times and we, like, shake our heads. Like, what were people thinking? White only. And it's like we have like a generational log in our eye, you know, like one generation looking at another generation, like, what were they thinking? And it made me think, like, well, one day will there be history books where people look back and say, what were these people thinking, killing their babies, you know? And then it's like, you know, really, Douglas Kelly, the guy from RTS, he was saying, he in his view, it's just a result, abortion is just a result of the sexual revolution, you know, that people wanted unrestrained, you know, immorality. Which, if you have unrestrained immorality for a long period of time, possibility of a baby being born, you know, and didn't want that. And he was like, if you follow the logic out, he said, if something doesn't change, he said, this may seem absurd to y'all, but he said, I'm telling you, if something doesn't change, eventually, he said, it may not happen in my generation, but eventually, like, it's going to be a culture of death on the other end of life, too. Wow. Euthanasia.
Yeah.
Well, there was a guy coming here the other day, one of the rep guys. I didn't know they were doing this. I guess I heard it. Forgot, I don't know. But they wanted a girl, and they did a chrome with, like, a cleanse.
You could spell.
Yeah. Or something. and had a girl, like did a IVF procedure, but like told the doctor they wanted a girl. You know, I mean, it's, I don't know what's going to happen in a few years. Like, there's, they're trying to unlock some of these genes so that they can, like, design people with, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Like, say you want blonde hair and blue eyes. You know. It's, yeah.
Yeah, it'd be something, though. I mean, when you think about it, it's the same when you get an abortion. I mean, normally, when you get one, it's, you wanted to just have unprotected physical relations, and then you didn't want it to get in the way of your life. That's really it. So it's the same logic on the other end. Dad's gone, his mind is gone, he's just laying in the bed all day, he's just dragging down our worldly life. Like,
get rid of it.
Yeah.
I think the biggest thing holding it back is that there's all this money, like there's still, the government's still able to hold up, you know, in our country at least. All these people who are spending all this time in nursing homes, they really don't cost the kids any money. Like if they're below a certain poverty line, I think the government covers it.
Well, that's what Doug Kelly brought up. He said, even on that end, he said he thinks eventually the government, like he said, all sin has consequences in abortion. He actually made this comment. He said he didn't think we would have that many Mexican workers today if there hadn't been so many abortions. And he was like, eventually one generation is going to die. And it's like, we're not going to have no workers. And like, who's going to pay for everything? And
that's already happened.
It's already, yeah, the Social Security system and everything. So it's eventually, if it's left unchecked, it's eventually going to crumble the society.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think he's spot on. Like, you're right. Like, you just can't keep, like, there's an effect. You know, the Lord's orchestrated consequences. But I think the reason it's not as big of a temptation for euthanasia, if they're doing this to unborn babies, I don't think it to me it's the same principle being
mm-hmm.
applied.
Okay.
So the only reason I think you don't see widespread euthanasia is because the government is keeping these people, like they're paying
right.
the bill.
Right.
If it came down the American dream, that
oh, yeah.
dead calls, it's like $200 a day in some of these nursing homes.
Yeah.
And that hits you, and now he's like, well, is he going to, like, I'm going to talk about rounding off the day.
Yeah. It would. Ain't a doubt in my mind it would. And it wouldn't be long, and everyone's conscience would be seared to it, and it'd just be a part of life. Yeah, you're right, because if it does come down, I mean, when it does come down with its weight, with its monetary weight, it's either be humble and serve one another or kill. it's going to be a choice.
Yeah.
And he was saying, he said, this thing does crumble. He was like, it's going to be, he used the word hellish. Like, it's he said, I'm no prophet. I don't know, you know, what the Lord's plan is. But
looking forward to that, knowing that I purchased long-term health care a number of years ago. But with the way things are escalating,
a lot of those policies don't even, they're just mere shadows of what they used to cover.
So,
I mean, yours is probably good, but I'm saying the new ones.
Yeah, the
or just not.
But it keeps climbing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you got to add, and your coverage keeps
going down.
Well, the value of it. So as you continue to look at it, you get to saying,
you moving up me this before.
Is it worth it? You know, there's at some point. It's kind of like the amount of life insurance you got. At some point, it costs more than
than the casket.
Than what you really don't need, you know.
Right.
Mm. So.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But.
Well, I guess we'll cover sin next time. Going to 24. Mm-hmm. Keep moving. Make some progress.
Who is Doug Kelly?
He is a professor at Reformed Theological Seminary in Florida. He's kind of a hidden gem. He's not a known... He's not as known as, say, like R.C. Sproul was. But he's one of the smartest, Presbyterian evangelical writers in history and theology that I've come across. He's older too. He's definitely older now, but got a lot of knowledge to pass on. He's pretty funny too. He's countryfied, pretty hilarious guy. He's the one that when he was he's got lectures online if you want to listen to him. He they're free. But he's the one, he said when he was talking about man and woman becoming one flesh or whatever, he said he was talking about the baby boomer generation too, of which he said about the Social Security system and all that. He said, heck, you ain't gonna be able to, you're not gonna be able to get them off there. He said they, you're gonna have to about kill them to take their keys from them. He said they're not gonna want to give up anything. He said they're the selfish bunch that ever lived. He said, I should know, I'm one of them. But he said of this one guy who was talking about man leave his father and mother. He said, I was talking to one guy who's struggling in his marriage. He wasn't wanting to cut his apron strings all the way from his mama. And he said, somehow I got involved on sitting in on a talk one time with it. And he said the man was complaining that his wife wasn't a good cook. Going down to his mama's house to eat all the time. And he said, I sort of lost my southernness. And he said, you say she's not a good cook. And he said, yeah, he said, that's the best thing that ever happened to you. He said, look at you, overweight. Like... It was funny. And he's always got something funny. He's a playful guy. But real serious, too. I enjoy it. I get a lot from him. I used to listen to him on UPS. All them RTS. The RTS.edu. You can listen to all kind of stuff for free. Yeah. You can literally listen to the whole, nearly their whole...
There's stuff out there today.